This is Behemoth. I don't know if you've seen this in the booth. Has everybody been down to the booth and actually had a close-up look at the bike already? Does anybody not know anything of what this is about? Can I sort of leap into the cool stuff? Great. Okay. My name is Steve Roberts, and I've been wandering around the country for about 9 years now in various incarnations of this thing. The machine that's sitting here is known as Behemoth, which is an acronym for Big Electronic Human-Energized Machine, only too heavy. It is actually a... it's a successor to earlier machines known as the Winnebiko. It took off back in 1983 upon realizing that I was doing things that I didn't enjoy anymore, trying to pay for things I really didn't want after all. I had a house in suburbia in Columbus, Ohio, and I was working my tail off doing things that had once been a hobby, writing and designing embedded control processors for industrial applications and all this really fun stuff. And when I started realizing that the work was no longer much fun, because you know what happens when you turn a hobby into a business, when I started realizing I was doing that kind of stuff to pay for this lifestyle that was really rather miserable, it occurred to me that perhaps the best approach was to see if I could come up with a list of passions and then base a lifestyle on them. So I did. I made this little list of things like travel and adventure and computers, bicycles, romance, learning, publishing, networking, ham radio, tinkering with electronics, all that good stuff, and decided that the obvious solution was to sell my house in suburbia and move to a bicycle with a computer on board, live in the networks, travel full-time while writing for a living. So I did. That has turned into about 17,000 miles of nomadness. And initially, I took off solo on the early version of this, which is the Winnebiko. It was a recumbent bicycle, carried a little laptop computer, had a solar panel to run it, plugged into CompuServe at payphones, leading to some interesting encounters. Like I guess it was the second day out, I was plugged into a payphone in western Ohio and sitting down on the pavement, and this old pickup truck pulled up alongside, and a farmer got out, and he was on his way to the M&M Cafe in Christiansburg, Ohio, and he saw me and just stopped dead in his tracks and walked over and checked the bike out very closely, peered at it, touched the chain. You know, he had his Caterpillar tractor hat. Finally, he spat tobacco juice into the weeds and said, "Are you with NASA?" So I said, why, yes, sir, this here is one of them loony excursion modules. So that sort of set the tone for the whole trip. I kind of became an agent of future shock. Back then in 83, the technology doesn't sound exciting from today's perspective, but the little Radio Shack Model 100 was like a whole computer you could carry. And I wandered around for about 10,000 miles and wrote a book called Computing Across America. The only problem was, as I noticed in West Texas, the trip was no magical cure for terrible work habits. And I was spending hours and hours pedaling, turning cranks, about 1,000 hours, in fact, per 10,000 miles, which is half of a business year. And as a hand-to-mouth struggling freelance writer, that's a pretty significant chunk of time. So in West Texas, it occurred to me that if I could play the flute and get 3 octaves out of effectively 9 fingers, then maybe I could play the handlebars and use it for text. So version 2 of this was born about a year or so later, called the Winnebiko 2. Had a binary handlebar keyboard, so I could type in ASCII. I had a packet radio, had a ham license, of course, and could do basic email with packet, added a cellular phone modem, could edit stories while writing, and did another 6,000 miles on both coasts, this time with my girlfriend at the time named Maggie. And we went, that went on for another couple of years. I'm glossing over these first two systems real fast because you really want to know about this one. The problem with the Winnebiko 2 is that it was architecturally inflexible, although it had a good name. The name, by the way, came from an encounter in a campground in Texas one day. I was had finished a filming with CBS Morning News and had hunkered down in the corner of the campground, the quietest spot I could find, had the tent set up, was making dinner, and this big motorhome pulled in right next to me with the engine running, and then started the generator, and he was upwind. And I was all relaxed, and now I'm smelling his fumes and everything. This is most irritating. And it sat there for a while, and then I heard this zzzz as the satellite dish went up so you could watch television. And then this kind of clunk as the hydraulic step went down, to make getting in and out comfortable. And finally, this very large person sort of backed out of the motorhome, wrestling with some object with wheels and tubing and cables and things. And when I could finally see what it was, I realized it was a lawnmower. He had a little lawn boy, and he mowed the grass around the campsite. And then set up, edged a little walkway and set up the lawn furniture and the hibachi. And this went on. The setup was incredible. In the morning, he said, "Oh, I live down in Houston. Just like to come up to God's country, get away from it all." And So as a joke, I called the bike the Winnebiko, and it took years to live that down and get rid of the name. But anyway, so the problem with the Winnebiko too, even though I could write while riding, is that it was architecturally inflexible, and anytime I wanted to add something, like putting the cellular phone modem in, it was all this dedicated hard wiring and hacking switches that once did other things in order to get them to reroute audio, and you know, it was a mess. So the idea then became to do one that was all software-driven. Now, it was a lot of hardware for something that's supposedly all software, but basically what's going on here is we have this very flexible architecture. The idea, the objective is to have my physical location become completely irrelevant. I want to be able to travel full-time, wander freely with no constraints whatsoever, and still be on the net, able to communicate, compute as effectively as I want to, have all the tools that I would have if I was sitting at a workstation at a desk in Silicon Valley, have all the power generation I need, be able to maintain the system, you know, all of that stuff, but be able to wander freely with no constraints and no home base. So Behemoth was born. There's a 72-watt solar panel that powers everything. There's a Macintosh in the console that's sort of the front-end system, and it sits on top of 368 HC11s running forth that are responsible for doing all the low-level control, and what that translates into is power management, turning all the loads on and off, routing audio around the bike, these little cross-point switch matrices, so the audio is all networked. So if I want to make a cellular phone call, for example, it's merely a matter of four or five lines of forth code to turn on the appropriate bits in the cross-point switches to connect the speaker, the helmet microphone to the cellular phone's input and the helmet speaker to the cellular phone's output. So there's no dedicated wires that connect any of those kinds of resources. likewise, serial networking is all done that way. The applications on the bike, the front end of the system is a Mac, and basically that's for writing and running the graphic user interface to the control system, which is HyperTalk. A couple of DOS machines, one of which runs a heads-up display in the helmet, which takes one of the private eyes, and that takes care of things like accessing my database of contacts. I have a hospitality database of somewhere around 5,000 contacts around the country, and invitations, because, you know, despite all this technology, we still have this problem of needing a shower and a place to sleep and things like that. So when I pull into an unfamiliar town, the idea, of course, is to scan the database, who do I know around here, highlight the phone number field, call them, and say, well, I'm, you know, within so many miles. And then there's a Spark station now on the back. I've always wanted to ride a unicycle. So it does make balance a little more difficult because it's rather heavy, but it's right behind the seat in a little pack. That's there. I haven't really done too much with it. I can't use that while mobile at the moment. The handlebar keyboard is not connected to it. But that's there for things like image processing and running PPP to connect through the internet via cellular phone, which these guys will talk a lot more about because they know a lot more about it. So what we got here is a lot of computing horsepower that really lets me be just about anywhere. Now, the real thing that's exciting about the bike from the perspective of this show is communications. And that's kind of my favorite set of toys. The white dome in the back there is my link to the internet. And John Nornberg here from Qualcomm will give you technical details, but basically what it is a method of connecting to the internet for mail only via a satellite. It's a direct link to the GTE G-Star satellite. And I run a program called Eudora, which is a mail tool in the Macintosh, which goes out and uses that as a resource to connect to the hub down in Qualcomm, which is then sitting on SurfNet. So I can be pedaling along and get email that just pops up on the screen and generate it and so on. In fact, it even location stamps all my outgoing email with latitude and longitude data. So it's really, I can run, but I can't hide now. Everybody, that's In addition to that, there's a cellular phone modem from Telebit. I have a cell blazer. So if I'm near a cell site and want to move some high-speed data, that runs about, realistically, 10K baud, Dave, over cellular? About 10K. And then there's, of course, a fax machine as well built into the Mac PowerBook and also a little fax board. Plus, the cellular phone is interfaced to the rest of the stuff on the bike via what's called a cell jack from Telular, which is basically gives you a modular phone jack on a cellular phone. So that takes care of the credit card verifier and the cordless phone with answering machine and all those other basic tools. In fact, when the bike takes a message, it says something to the effect that, I'm sorry, I'm not on the bike at the moment, but when I'm back on the road, I'll get your message and call you back. There's also a fairly robust ham radio station that I can't use for business traffic, of course, but I can do packet with that and voice on HF, VHF, and UHF. And all of this runs under solar power while under control of handlebar keyboard and heads-up display and head mouse while I'm pedaling along. So that's the really brief overview. So I think the format of this today, just because I know mostly interactive questions are the most fun, we're just going to go through our successive presentations here, and I'm going to turn it over to John, who will talk more about the satellites, and then to these folks, who will talk about the communications via cellular and PPP. And then we'll reserve most of the time for questions, rather than doing lots of long monologues. So, are you ready? Okay. Here comes John Nuremberg. Thank you, Steve. Whoop. Uh-oh. There we go. Thank you. Well, I'm real good at this AV stuff, so we'll just try and do our best. As Steve was saying, that one of the things that we wanted to do is we wanted to get this bicycle behemoth connected to the internet. Now, that's what the project has become known as, at least as far as I'm concerned. It's called Bike Tracks. Bike Tracks because we're using the OmniTrack satellite network, and behemoth, well, because it's big. Now, there's several aspects of how are we going to get connected to the internet. First of all, there's several things that constrain us. Behemoth is a mobile environment. Steve lives on the bicycle, and we have to be able to provide connectivity when he's rolling down the road. Now, he wanders all over the place. He's not necessarily within the cellular network. He's not always able to plug into some fixed wire system. So we just can't rely on the cellular network, the telephone network, in order to be able to provide communication. After we looked at the kinds of connectivity that that Steve really needed in order to be able to communicate with the people on the net that are his the basis of his relationships. And what it came down to really is providing electronic mail as the primary means of connecting. So that's what I decided I would focus on. Some of the other things that limited as far as the satellite connectivity is that the OmniTrax network is actually a very low bandwidth system. So the idea of doing continuous TCP/IP across that link was just completely unrealistic. So by focusing on the essential protocols that we need in order to be able to do electronic mail, that was that solved our problems with how we would connect. I'm coming to that.
Oh, sorry.
I'm coming to that. Okay. So what is the end user? Well, Behemoth is a rich electronic environment. It has a lot of different ways of connecting. The other thing that I thought was particularly important is that he uses the Macintosh as his primary interface to getting into the systems on the bicycle. It made sense to use the Macintosh as the way in which he would that would be where his electronic mail user agent would reside. As far as Qualcomm's part in this, well, why would Qualcomm want to be involved in this? Well, I'll talk perhaps a little bit later. I'll talk about why we would want to do it, but we're certainly in the right sort of position. We're well connected to the internet. We're a SurfNet a member and sponsor, so we have a regular and reliable connection to the internet. We also operate this OmniTrax satellite network. Now, I've been talking about OmniTrax, and Steve wants me to get on with it, so I'll tell you a little bit about what OmniTrax is. OmniTrax, let's see. Is it possible to? Can we get that a little brighter? Dim the other lights. Take down the spots a little bit. Well, maybe this pointer will help here. Okay, OmniTrax is a two-way messaging service that uses geosynchronous satellites to connect long-haul trucks to our satellite hub in San Diego. The satellite hub connects with the dispatcher using terrestrial landlines in order to be able to send and receive messages that way. So as a result, the dispatcher can send a message to the truck saying that, well, your next load is in Columbus, Ohio, or you need to stop in Chicago in order to be able to pick up this part of your traffic. Or when the customer calls, where is that delivery of panels? The dispatcher can look on his display, and because of the fact that we always have positioning information,
the dispatcher knows, you say, well, he's 10 miles outside of Chicago, he'll be there in 20 minutes. This is a tremendous advantage for our customers. Now, the essential nature of this is that riding on top of this is there's this the outdoor unit, which is the satellite dome that you can see on the back of the bike, and a black box, which is the mobile communications terminal, or MCT, which is positioned somewhere down in the body of the cab. And then there's a display unit inside the cab that the truck driver uses to type on his Qualcomm, as we often told that our name is pronounced, in order to send and receive his messages. Now, for a truck, this is a lightweight system, but it's not really that light for Behemoth. So what we decided to do is we would toss out the display unit and just concentrate on using the Macintosh as the front end. So here we are. We have an internet cloud, or as someone insisted, these were my footprints instead of networks, but we have an internet cloud, an Omnitrax network cloud, and a bicycle that all have to be connected. Well, what are you going to do? Well, naturally, you're going to build a couple of bridges. You're going to build a bridge between the internet and Omnitrax, and a bridge between Omnitrax and the bike. And how did we go about building that bridge? Well, the first thing was, first bridge I'll talk about is between the internet and Omnitrax. Wrong button. Okay, what we have is a Sun workstation. It says Sun 4260. And, well, I have to tell you a story about this workstation. It was, I was used to seeing Spark stations, ones and one pluses. That's what we had around Qualcomm. And I had never seen a Sun 4260 before. So when Jeff Barris had offered us this computer to use for our bridge, I said, great, I'll come up and get it, thinking that, well, this is going to be a piece of cake. Well, I got there, and we rolled these two tall, big, heavy boxes out of the lab at Sun Microsystems, and this great big 21-inch monitor, and filled a station wagon with this thing. Well, this is a big computer. I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to deal with this, but I'll take this big computer back with me to San Diego, and we'll set it up, and I'll put it in my office. I'll still get this thing in my office, and I'll use that to build the bridge. Well, I got it into down to San Diego and put it into hooked it up on our net in our office. And first time I turned it on, I realized that a Sun 4260 comes equipped with I think they must be turbines that they use to cool this thing off. This thing was noisy. It was big and noisy. And so instantly it became the big noisy computer, which is our mail connector. The three parts of this is a daemon that runs the protocol between the network management center, the NMC that I mentioned before, that's our Omnitrax hub, and it translates the protocol that we use for Omnitrax, and it takes mail, incoming and outgoing mail, and in a shared directory that's our spool. Messages that are coming from the internet go through a process called message to NMC to translate into our Omnitrax protocol, and NMC to message does the inverse translation and sends them back out the door to the internet. Now, the three things about each client: the BNC daemon is it's an NMC client. It's using our private customer interconnect protocol, which is essentially a hex ASCII protocol. The idea is that we are sending a spread spectrum signal, and we're encoding these symbols to go out over the air. But we use a reduced character set in order to be able to send to match to our modulation. The message to NMC is taking A22 messages and translating them into this into the Qualcomm format. And as I mentioned, we're going back from the hex ASCII to RFC A22 at the other end. On the bike itself, we use Eudora as the user agent. Now, Steve can use Eudora regardless of what his connectivity is. But when he's using the satellite system, what we do is we have Eudora talk to, using the COM toolbox on the Macintosh, we have a COM toolbox tool called MCT tool that plays the role of the SMTP server or the POP server that Eudora expects to talk to. It accepts the messages or sends messages to Eudora, and it it uses an intermediate directory, a spool directory, for storing the information. In order to, the driver that that drives the MCT, the mobile communications terminal, is called MCT display, and it's runs as a background process most of the time. It also has a front end for controlling obtaining status about the MCT. But it runs as a background process on the Macintosh in order to be able to drive the MCT. It takes our A22 messages, decomposes them into a set of messages that are suitable for Omnitracs, and then injects them into the satellite system. The way Omnitracs works is delivery is guaranteed, but it takes a while for the messages to flow over this low bandwidth network. So each part is transmitted in turn and then reassembled at the other end. And that happens both on the BNC and on the Macintosh on the bike. Just to summarize here, the Eudora is his user agent, and he uses it regardless of the environment that he is using for his transport at that particular time. Eudora always expects to be an SMTP and a POP3 client, so that's what the MCT tool has to emulate. And although it's not a complete implementation, it's just enough to satisfy Eudora. MCT display is responsible for doing the polling to talk to the MCT and do the translation from our RFC A22 style messages into the binary format that we send over the air. So now we're connected. We have the BNC between the internet and Omnitracs and MCT display, Eudora, and MCT tool running on the PowerBook, connecting the bike to the internet for sending mail while Steve literally is rolling down the road. The main thing to think about is this is a consistent interface. Uses the same thing always, regardless of what he's doing. It's easy to use. Eudora is a simple to use program, people are not only Steve. I had some trouble convincing him to use it the first time. It took a little while to get him to switch over to Eudora, but once I had done that, now he keeps telling me what a wonderful program this is. So I think he's convinced. And it's always available, regardless of it's available when he's on the road, when he's connected to a network, or when he's using a dial-up line to connect into our bridge at Qualcomm. Now, I didn't do all this work to connect this up myself. I have to make sure I thank some of the people that are that contributed to the satellite connection as well. Jeff Baer was at Sun Microsystems was kind enough to help us out with obtaining the 4260, the big noisy computer that we're able to use for the bridge. Carl Fox is going stepped in at the last minute and helped with some work that we needed to get done in order to be able to make sure that Steve didn't flood Omnitracs with all this mail that I know you're all going to send him now. Most of the software that runs on the BNC was written by a fellow that I work with at Qualcomm. Some of you may know him. His name is Greg Knoll, and he did yeoman's work to get that all together. And at the very end, John Perlia stepped in and helped me out with some of the Macintosh stuff. So I'm really grateful for all of their help. But the fact that they were willing and able to participate in this is just, and yet I think why I got pulled into this whole project is because of the romance and the excitement of being part of this idea of nomadic existence. That's why I'm here today, because this is just a neat thing. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
My
name is Carl Fox. I'm from Morningstar. I live in Columbus, Ohio. I work at a job where I work all day and all night, keeping my nose to the grindstone, turning a hobby into my profession, and so far I still like it, although I do really enjoy riding my bike. Oh, it's already there. Focus, reverse. Where's the go button? Right. Wow. Okay. I had heard about Steve for several years, but I never really heard much detail until someone put a magazine on my desk open to an article about him that described all the fancy gadgets that he had on his bike. He had a spark station, which surprised me. He had modems. He had email connectivity, but it was... I had lived for a long time with UUCP connectivity to email, and it was really nice until we got an internet connection in our office. And I don't know. I've never used drugs, but it must be like what you experience when you start using them. And I wanted to infect others with the same disease. So we've made a product that allows people on the cheap to get connected to the internet. And after reading this article, I realized that he had everything he needed. Everything he needed to be connected, except our software. He had one bike. He had two modems, more than he needed. And all sorts of different ways of connecting up to various places to establish his connections, most of them single session oriented. Wrong button. There we go. So we invited them to come to our office. He came by for a day that turned into a week, and ended up with one bike, two modems, and a fully connected mobile IP host, mobile internet connected host. He had IP connectivity. We turned on every security knob we could find. He has name service to the rest of the internet, SMTP mail if he decides he wants to use that, network time service if he wants to make sure that his clocks stay accurate to within 12 milliseconds, like mine it always is now. Clocks just aren't accurate anymore, you know. My Spark Station isn't accurate. It wavers all over the place. If I unplug it from the internet, it's 20, 30 milliseconds off. Well, no discussion of network connectivity would be complete without a network diagram. So here's a network diagram. The internet is up there where it says internet, and that's connected to Qualcomm, where Steve's 4260 sits. Fortunately, not in John's office. From there, we can connect to the bike or Steve's business office in El Segundo, right. What he ended up with is a PPP link layer protocol, which provides error detection through checksumming. There's a link quality monitoring feature which monitors the line and can tell whether you're getting good throughput or whether you're losing packets, things like that. We have both password security and challenge handshake authentication protocol, which is part of the PPP protocol suite to verify who you are when you try to connect. And it dials on demand. If he has his modem hooked up to it, all he has to do is say Telnet or R-Login or FTP, and he can go anywhere he wants. When he's done with it, it hangs up automatically, and we can let some packets through, not others. We can bring the line up for some packets, not for others. For example, when I first implemented our product, I wanted to dial on demand. I thought that would be so neat. I had already figured out how to make it hang up automatically, but once it, you can either push the button on the modem. Telebit provides a handy little knob right there. You push that, and it goes click. But I wanted to be able to bring it up and shut down whenever I wanted to. So I put it in, and I sat back waiting to revel in my success. I hung up the modem, and 20 seconds later, it dialed again, even though I hadn't done anything. So I stopped it, and I sat back, and it dialed again. And it's because my network time protocol packets were dialing the phone every minute. So I realized that dial-on-demand wasn't enough, so you need to put in yet more further features. So this is Steve's packet filter configuration on Lorien, the 4260. And it defines what sorts of things we care about and which sorts of things we don't care about. We don't care about, well, we care sort of about if under the pass filter, those are things that we don't allow to get through. So we do allow, well, everything that's named there, you do. Everything with an exclamation mark means don't do it. So we let through network time protocol, but if you look up above, we don't allow it to keep the lineup. So solving my headache. We do allow him to tell net out, to FTP out, to do pings, domain name service, things like that. But we don't allow other people to telnet in. Although it would probably be a lot of fun for most of us to say that they'd done anonymous FTP to a bike. We weren't sure that what it would do to his throughput if he had 100 people trying to do that every day.
And my cellular phone charger.
Yeah, right. He has to actually pay money for this stuff. So that's basically it. In conclusion, in my opinion anyway, PPP, dialing on demand, provides the ultimate in transparent mobile IP connectivity. Plus, of course, software has a favorable function to weight ratio. Next is Dave Harris of Telnet.
Thanks, Carl. I'm Dave Harris, Zonker at Telebit.com. Instead of writing software for a living or doing consulting gigs, I answer technical questions for Telebit's router products. We have a dial-in, dial-out IP services box, as well as make a couple of swell modems. One of the modems that we've got on the bike is something called a cell blazer. Don't worry about the screen. I have no slides to show. I wasn't sure where this was going to go today. The cell blazer is simply one of Telebit's regular modems that was enhanced for cellular use. One of the problems that you run into, modem technology has been around a while. It's been refined. High speeds are normal things these days instead of the old 300 and 1200 baud you had 6-7 years ago. On a cellular phone connection, you've got a lot of things that start to interrupt those data connections. When you're trying to get lots of speed transitions, lots of data across in a very short amount of time, static on a line, switching from one cell site to another. If you've used cellular phones, you'll hear the static rise and fall once in a while. There'll be blackouts occasionally as the cell is handed over to another set. For voice, this isn't a big deal because the person on the phone hears that static and transition and he pauses a little bit and he can speak and change. Computers don't pay attention to that. There's nothing inside of a protocol that's going to say, oh, wait a second, we're going to switch that cell site now. As cellular phones get closer to a cell, telemetry between the systems actually tell the phones themselves to raise or lower their power levels so that they can use the same frequency somewhere else. Part of that causes some of the static that you'll hear back and forth, and all of these serve to knock down the regular protocols. If you try and use a cellular-type interface and hook up standard modems, a lot of times, unless you're solid into the cell site and not moving around much, you don't have a lot of success. Telebit has a proprietary protocol that puts lots and lots of data on the carrier at one time and holds it there. Its transition rate is 7.5 times a second rather than 2,400 times a second for most protocols like V32, V32bis. So that's part of the success for the cell blazer is just adding a few other registers to what was normally a really robust protocol to allow that connection to survive cell site switching. Some of the timing delays that you would see where data not only has chunks out of it, but is also out of sync and has to reestablish itself. So the protocol itself stays online, simply reframes itself, picks up where it left off, and keeps you connected. Also has pretty high bandwidth while it's connected and doing things. It's a very adaptive protocol. The product that I support is a dial-in and dial-out slip and PPP product. It's primarily a TCP/IP routing product to tie in between systems on the networks and decide what traffic comes and goes. The box itself, like a terminal server you can get from Cisco and other places, allows you to do PPP or slip incoming calls. But there's also a section where outbound traffic from the network can bring up that phone connection like we were hearing earlier from the stuff that they've got down at Lorien making calls to the bike. These connections can dynamically come up and down as you need them. A lot of fun that's involved in that. All the things that were coming together on the bike were trying to come up with a good way to communicate. He had been using 2400 baud modems for the most part. Trying to use higher speed modems and getting more data onto that little tiny line was not being real successful. So my company sponsored the modem. Just about the time I was coming to work for them, my boss was a ham, I was a ham, and I had already been familiar with Steve and had read some of the original stories on CompuServe, hooked up with him at a ham radio meeting in the Bay Area while he had just dropped in on version 2 of the bike. And so when my new boss said, by the way, I'm going down to see Steve Roberts at the bike lab, do you want to come along? Sure. And while I was there, I found out that there were a lot of things attached and powered, but not quite connected yet. He gave me a tour of the bike and opened the hood and took me around, pointed at everything, and everything was just so cool. And said, was there anything I could do to help? I'm good with a soldering iron. And so he went ahead and thought about it, and granted, a lot of the stuff is donated to him, so it didn't cost him much money, but he usually gets one or two. You don't want to break one, you like to have a spare. So anyway, I got to put in the 2-meter radio in the console, which was a ham walkie-talkie that we stripped everything out of. Did a nice job on it, so he decided to keep me. And from there, I spent about a year helping to wire the bike. The experiment itself, I met a lot of people with diverse software or telecommunications backgrounds. There were also a lot of packaging constraints that we had to work with, mechanical, physical, electronic information that we had to all compile to make things go together. So it's been a terrific project. But the telecommunication side, getting things to talk electrically, RS-232 levels versus TTL levels versus RS-488, things like this, trying to get everything talking together, those were parts of my job. The interfacing itself really is getting to be easier and easier. There are a lot of conversions and easy things that you can do to mechanically and electrically tie these networks together and devices together. I'm an infomaniac as well. Having full internet privileges down at Telebit rather than just dial an email queued through a news spool and reading news. Being able to FTP to a university site and browse around and find new software for the Mac, for the PC, for DOS. I've become somewhat of a PC and Macintosh connectivity specialist at Telebit for our router products. We have another person in the group that does more Sun and other applications, and we've already written application notes on the Morningstar PPP and had great help from the folks at Morningstar. Wonderful stuff. The Macintosh stuff, Intercon, has a terrific all-for-one package, but there's also somebody at University of Texas that simply taught Mac TCP, which you can get with most of your network cards, taught it how to use the serial port, make a slip connection, which is another IP connectivity. Very bare, it's an older protocol. PPP is the son of slip. A lot more robust, a lot more features to it. But these kinds of software packages allow me to take my workstation at home, dial in someplace, start a session, and it's not like logging into a bulletin board anymore. What you get is open up a window, start to do a file transfer, and you get the index, and you decide, these are the things that I want. You say, get these files. And while it's doing that, then you open up a telnet session, and you log into a host, and you start checking for mail. And while you're browsing that, you open another session, and you start reading the news groups and browsing through Rec Humor Funny and some of the other things, all over the same modem connection. Everything happens at once, and the file transfer may slow down a little bit for a second while you're getting screen updates from mail or from the news group or checking the database. Telecommuting is going to be really a major part of what we're going to see in the future, I think, with all the emission standards problems we're seeing here in California, 93 and 94, 95. Electric cars have to be sold. Flex work and flex time, working from home, this dial-up connectivity and remote connectivity, not necessarily from a bike, but just from somebody's house, rather than having to go into work, is going to save a lot of people a lot of money. If an office doesn't have to supply a cubicle and a desk for 5 people, but they say, you come to work on Monday, you come to work on Tuesday, you come to work on Wednesday, you share the same desk, turn in your time cards, telecommute from home, you get to come in, do the little social thing with people in the office and stay connected that way with social activities. You're still doing the work from home. You haven't spent time in the commute. You can take lunch and go to Safeway and do your shopping and come back. You don't have to sweat daycare. You just say, Daddy's working right now. I'll talk to you. Go watch Sesame Street. You've got your Disney videos. You know, I'm working right now. If it's an emergency, you can stop and take care of it. And if it's not, you're teaching them a little bit of responsibility. Teach them how to tell time. Daddy's got to work till noon. I'll see you at 12 o'clock, and then we can play. So there are a lot of advantages to this. It's a magic technology, and it's to the point now where it's coming down to the common man. It's not just for corporate networking anymore. So any questions you have, I think we're about to the point. I'll pass it back to Steve, and then we'll start taking questions, I think.
So as you can see, bicycling just ain't what it used to be. Any questions? We got time to talk about anything you want, the lifestyle of being on the road, whatever. Yes? How do I fund myself? Well, a big part of this has been sponsorship, of course. I've tended to always avoid cash sponsorship, mostly because that can change the whole perception in the media. So there have been about 150 companies that have donated product to make this thing fly, and that, of course, has made a tremendous difference. As far as cash flow, I still have to eat. I haven't gotten food sponsors. So freelance writing, consulting, speaking engagements, things like that. I keep getting tempted to productize, but that tends to require total focus, so I've managed to avoid that so far. But, yeah. How many spokes on the back wheel? There are 48 spokes. Wait a minute. Yes, bike stuff. 48 spokes, and it's an undished wheel. And that's really the key thing. It's not only the number of spokes, but the fact that it's a symmetrical structure. It's really much more robust. I've never broken a spoke in 17,000 miles. Yes? Go ahead, John.
There you go. It's the aggregate for the channel is about 10 kilobits. So we use that to service currently about 30,000 units. So it's a small fraction of those are actually ever talking at once. The 165 bits is if you take the average length of time it takes to send a message, a full packet across the link, which it takes about 2 minutes. So a full packet is about 2,000 bytes. Works out to be about 165 bits per second.
Which is why I'm not using that path for active news groups, large GIFs, you know. I would be a very unwelcome guest on the satellite, I think, if I was just 24-hour-a-day communications trying to keep up. Yeah.
What about the cellular?
About 10 kbaud on cellular under normal conditions, and about 10 kbaud. Now it'll back off under sloppy conditions, and you know the PEP just retrains, and that's the right way to say it. It just retrains and adapts itself as conditions permit. And you can take the same modem and put it on a wire line, and it'll run about 19 kbaud. Yeah. Go ahead. It's a 3-watt cellular phone. Yeah. No, I haven't yet. I've had that one for quite a while, and on the new project, which I should probably touch on at some point. I may do something a little bit different, but that's an Oki 491 that's just repackaged down to circuit board level and built into the trailer, the comm bay. Yes? Okay, I'll talk about it now. the next machine is the CMOS microchip. It's essentially a computerized amphibian sea kayak. It'll start being constructed probably January 93. Looks like it's going to be hosted by University of Washington and hoping it'll launch around spring of 94. Short form, I don't want to go into a lot of detail about that now, but basically it's a kayak trimaran that's also amphibian. It has wheels that deploy and a folding recumbent bicycle that can come out of a hatch to tow it, so when I go on land I can. And why are you laughing? this is entirely reasonable. And two square meters of solar panels on the AKAs, which are the outriggers, and it has a pedal power drivetrain, so it's still a recumbent inside. There's a little swing down prop. You can pedal a kayak at about 8 to 9 knots, and you can paddle it at about 3.5 to 4 knots. So it's really remarkably effective. And then it has a small sail. The Qualcomm terminal will be mounted on the deck, and the Mac PowerBook XXX, whatever model is appropriate at the time, will be built into the console. and a lot less complexity. The obvious question, just to save somebody from the trouble of asking it, yes, it's going to go in salt water, and that, yes, that creates all sorts of nasty problems. And the plan right now is to have an air compressor with a dryer that can pressurize the equipment bay and the console so that anything that contains sensitive electronics is constantly under positive pressure. So if it does tend to leak, which, you know, eventually there'll be some little leak, instead of thermally breathing salt air, it'll just outgas and sound an alarm telling me to get my soap bubbles out and find it. So, you know, I think more and more people are making tools that that apply well to nomadic connectivity. The Mobidem, you know, the Ram Mobile's got a booth here at the show. I mean, that's pretty cool stuff. There's all these different ways of getting email in your pocket now, and I can see it changing real fast. As far as making a living on the road, one of my favorite little stories, there's a couple, the Veldhuizens from Holland, who bicycled around the world a few years ago on recumbents. And to make a living, they were doing aerial photography. Just as an extreme case of this nomadic information business, photography is information. They get someplace and arrange a barter for aerial photographs of somebody's land or town in exchange for support. And what they would do is uncork a PVC tube from the back of the bike, fly a radio-controlled camera, and take pictures. So, yeah. Anybody have a better answer for that for me? I mean, I want to just look at it from a rosy standpoint and say, sure, but I don't really know. I'm not sure what the status of those other systems is. The thing that was so attractive about the Qualcomm system is that it does cover all of North America and Europe and Japan and soon Australia just by changing a ROM, and you don't have to be near cellular service areas. Near a cellular service area, you have the advantage of much higher speed and higher performance, but the cool thing about that is that, I mean, about the satellite is that I generally like to travel in places that aren't near cities. There is one good little hack, by the way, that you should know about. If you do a lot of cellular phone communications and you're away from cities a lot and you're frustrated by range limitations, contact Larsen Antennas and get the YA5806. It's a six-element cellular Yagi. It's a beam antenna. It's not really legal, I don't think. But it's wonderful. I've tested it to a little over 100 miles. And I could stand in Anacortes, Washington, and the islands off Puget Sound and make a local call in Seattle, turn the antenna, make a local call in Vancouver. So, cellular phone DXing. Yeah. Yeah. I know nothing. It's Larsen Electronics in Vancouver, Washington. They make lots of ham antennas, and it's a cellular beam. I think it's pretty promising. As a writer, I'm not really excited about it because I find it rather difficult to effectively write using speech. I've tried dictating stories, and they never come out very well. I have a Kovac speech recognition board on the bike. I haven't really been using it just for commands, and I've seen demos of some that are really effective, like the voice navigator for the Mac is pretty cool. There's a learning curve associated with this, and learning to use it effectively. Certainly for commands and dealing with and doing email and things like that, it would make a lot of sense. On the bike, of course, reality is always the non-maskable interrupt. If a truck is incoming, you know, from the starboard beam, and I'm cruising along typing, then I abort the typing in order to save myself. I do notice sometimes that there's a kind of, this isn't exactly on the subject of your question, but there's sometimes a sort of confusion on a subtle level, a perceptual level, not an intellectual level, between reality and all the stuff that I'm surrounded with, because I've got all these screens and little windows, and there's a little mirror here, which is reality behind me, and there's a window here, which is a DOS machine, and there's all these things on the console. And if I'm, you know, cruising along, somebody walks down the street who I'm very interested in, I want to turn with my head mouse, and I expect the cursor to follow, and I want to double-click, you know. So that may be an interesting set of problems that we'll run into as we do more and more of wiring ourselves. Yeah. Well, first of all, the speed I make, I tend to cruise 9 to 11 miles an hour depending on what I have for breakfast and whether it was coffee or latte, you know, those kinds of variables. I'm rather slow with this. It's a fairly leisurely pace, and I rode with somebody, a woman named Susan, last summer, who joined me in Wisconsin for about 3 or 4 weeks to go for a ride. And she was so nervous when she showed up. We had a rendezvous in Wisconsin, and she was so afraid that she was going to have trouble keeping up with the famous cyclist who she'd read about, you know. And she really wanted to train, but didn't have the time, so she's all apologetic. And you know, within a couple of days, you know, when we got it into the hilly country, you know, she'd wait for me very sweetly at the top of every hill, and just very patient. So I find I can maintain a fairly average speed of around 9. That's a good all-day pace.
If it gets real hilly. Now, see, the thing is, this thing is so heavy that I've got some really killer granny gears. The low gear, there's 105 gears. That was necessary. The lowest gear is 7.9 inches, which translates into, you can tell the cyclists in the audience, the ones who recognize 7.9 inches is a very funny number. One pedal revolution is 22 inches of forward travel. Or put another way, a cadence of 60 is 1.2 miles an hour. So that's why it has landing gear. Those little wheels are pneumatically deployed, and when I get to a really steep hill, I just push a button and they swing down and lock so I can go infinitely slowly up a hill. So I've had it to 50.5 at the other extreme. That's with gravity assist. Other question? Yeah. Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you. Well, your check will be in the mail. I publish a magazine from the road. It's a quarterly journal called Nomadness. And it's, I was about to say it's available here at the show, but we're basically out of the booth now. We do have some flyers that are sitting on the solar panel, so help yourself there. You can subscribe to it. It's $15 a year. It's a quarterly. And it's kind of 50-50 tales of the adventure itself and the technology that makes it possible. And more now we're turning toward articles that really try to help other people apply this. So we're doing articles about all kinds of different things that let you be nomadic and still effectively connected. So the things about connectivity tools and power management and using solar panels and building mobile labs and packaging and all that sort of stuff, as well as what I did in Wisconsin. So, yeah. Nothing unusual ever happens. I don't... gee, there's all kinds of them. Gosh, where do I begin? Well, they range, you know, there's a lot of levels of magnification. We should take that question. There are a lot of little moment-to-moment encounters that are just the funny things people say, of course. You know, as you can imagine, this attracts commentary. I used to leave a tape recorder on a lot when I'd go into a restaurant in a small town and then play the tape on my way to the next town. And one guy in a small town in Texas was standing there looking at it, and he said, "Damn, that dude could survive a nuclear war." I'm trying to think of a prototypical encounter. There aren't any. I guess one of the ones that's the sort of the one of the more bizarre encounters was on the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal towpath. I was cruising along along the Potomac River. This is a 184-mile-long bike trail that runs from Cumberland, Maryland, to Washington, D.C. And it's pretty idyllic. It's kind of like a Bambi movie. You know, you're on this little path in the woods for 184 miles without any hills. You're right along the river, no highways. And there's this one section where Interstate 70 runs parallel to this path. And I saw that there'd been a giant truck wreck. It was a very startling thing to see. And I stopped and I looked over and a semi had rolled down a hill. It was all split apart. There's cop lights. I mean, there's all this bustle. And it was a really incongruous sight. So I was sitting there and I was just drinking water and kind of relaxing for a moment and contemplating this strange contrast when there was this rustle in the leaves behind me and five of the biggest, meanest, toughest looking men I've ever seen in my life stepped out of the woods. And I know to tell this in any kind of a mixed audience, I have to give you a disclaimer here. This is profoundly edited, toned down language, okay? So one of them said, "What the hell is this?" And I said, "Well, it's a bicycle and it's kind of like a race, so I got to go now." and another one said, "Oh, you got a gun on that thing, man?" And I said, no gun. I thought about it, but figured it would just get me in trouble. And he said, "I heard that. You don't be messing with no gun. It'll get you 15 years in Maryland. Just ask me." So I said, where are you guys from? And this one guy had this sort of real burly, scarred-up redhead with a long ponytail said, "We're convicts from the federal penitentiary up at Hagerstown." So, "Oh, great. You escaping or what?" And he started to answer, and then the first guy interrupted him and said, I think we ought to fix our traveling man up here, don't you?" And he put his hand on my shoulder, and I can't really protest. So I ended up walking off into the woods with these guys, sort of toward the truck wreck, I have some misgivings, as you might imagine, and as we were walking, I noticed that there was this yellow truck with a cop sitting on it with a shotgun in his hand. And I said, "You guys like a work release crew or something?" He says, "You got it. We're here to clean up that truck over there." And I, good. But we didn't go to the truck. Instead, we walked off into the woods in a little clearing. And in the clearing, there was a giant mound, a big tarp-covered mound about waist high. And the big guy, this giant, said, "This is our stash, man. The truck was full of this." And I, so what they've been doing is stealing stuff from the truck wreck that they were cleaning up, stashing it in the woods, and now they want to share it with me. this is great. Stereos, roller bearings. I have no idea what to expect, but I wasn't sure I wanted to start receiving stolen goods, so I'd be living with these guys soon. Anyway, he reached down and pulled the tarp back with a flourish, and underneath was a giant mound of Sara Lee pastries. So he reached down, handed me a box, says, have some walnut cake. This is excellent. Another guy handed me one. Another guy handed me a box, said, man, you won't be noticing no damn walnut cake. You want cheese Danish. That's where it's at. And pretty soon I had this armload of this stuff while these murderers and bank robbers are standing around arguing over which ones are best. And it's totally surreal. So we went back to the bike, and I said, look, I don't have room for all this. And they started plucking it out of my hands and shoving it under bungee cords and between packs. And, like, the bike was just festooned with pastries. So I've met a lot of strange people on the trip, I think, but I think the convicts take the cake. So. Thank you. Yes? I wouldn't want to do that. I've actually ridden through San Francisco before, but when I'm in the trade show circuit and doing speaking gigs and things like that, I also have a mothership, which is a big diesel truck with a mobile laboratory, and I can haul this thing around rapidly and deploy it and take it into places like Manhattan to do the Donahue show or here to do Interop. I agree. Riding around in San Francisco is fairly painful. I've done it twice. When I came down the West Coast, I went through, but I just stayed pretty close to the water. And then one day I was doing an evening magazine filming, and they had me doing hide in Lombard, you know. It was easy for him. He's standing there with a camera saying, okay, let's run that through again, you know. So, but yeah, I agree with you. I tend to, when I'm on the bike, I tend to do as much research as I can as I approach a town. Find the bike paths, talk to bikies, anything I can do to find out the routes that are non-fatal. And it doesn't always work. And I've been stuck in places like commute routes at rush hour that are pretty horrible, which is another one of the motives for moving to the water eventually. There's some pretty major terrors associated with the asphalt and, of course, the water, too. But, you know, the hills and bad drivers and drunks and broken glass and potholes. And, you know, they're as romantic and wonderful as 17,000 miles has been. I want to try to combine it with some other media now just to get a break from that. So, more. Yes. A couple times, a guy opened his pickup truck door in front of me in Whiteville, North Carolina. Not intentionally, but that slowed me down for a while. Really trashed his door, too. Then I did an incompetent U-turn in wine country once. There's some correlation. But nothing really serious, just minor injuries. Nevertheless, there's at least one moment of pure terror per day. So, yeah. What kind of relationship? Well, I had a nomadic partner for a long time. Maggie traveled with me for about 5 years. Basically, I was after my first 10,000 miles, I was in Ohio just doing some consulting and was realizing that I wanted to get back on the road, so I was starting to build the Winnebago 2, and we met in a... I had an HP laptop, and I was in a jazz bar one night with it at about midnight drinking a beer and answering email. Unfortunately, I wasn't connected. I was answering email offline. Now we don't have to do that. We can just, you know, link up. Anyway, she was sitting a couple tables away. One thing led to another. I took her home to see my bicycle. And 3 weeks later, I said, hey, you want to go for a bike ride? And she said, okay. And I said, good. Quit your job, sell your car, trash your lifestyle, get a recumbent, and we'll leave in 6 months. So, you know, nomadic relationships are great. They're measured in terms of miles. We did 6,000 miles together. And now, of course, the other way of maintaining relationships is through the net. I would say most of my close contacts. I mean, if I meet somebody and we want to stay in communication and they're not on the internet or at least something reachable through the internet, it's almost pointless to attempt it. I mean, you know, matter transfer. There are people who still use this form of communication. It's really quaint. They make hard copy to begin with of their note. And then they wrap it up and seal it in this enclosure, and they glue on a little receipt that indicates they've paid the communications charges already. And then they hand it to people who actually carry it cross-country. And it's arcane and a bit charming, but you know when you get used to living on the net, it's really absurd, especially if you're nomadic. So, so the data space has really become home. Yeah. Well, the little quip I've come up with on that subject is that as complexity approaches infinity, MTBF approaches zero. That's really not true, though, because fortunately a lot of the stuff that's becoming infinitely complex is also really robust and stable. You know, the packaging's getting better and better and all surface mount and, you know. So it's I don't know. I don't really have a good answer. There are so many different kinds of potential failures. You know, I mean, do we count flat tires right up there with you know, lost packets? you know. It's not too bad. I carry a fair amount of R&D stuff on the road with me. I have a portable oscilloscope and a digital multimeter, the little Fluke, beautiful units. My documentation library is now in microfiche, and I have a pocket microfiche viewer. Butane soldering irons, a little ultra torch. So, you know, a lot of things that come up, if it's a hardware problem, I can just deal with it. You know, stop by the side of the road or a little rest area. It doesn't work quite as well. I don't carry a brazing torch with me. So when I had a frame failure in Wisconsin, I had to call a tow truck. He got a kick out of that too, let me tell you. He's kind of walking around scratching his head going, well, what do you want me to do with it? Yeah. Yes, actually. But only for the mothership. I should sometime just get on the cellular phone and call them and have them come give me a jump start or something. I did a filming with Beyond 2000 from Australia once, and we met in L.A. We were at some fancy hotel in Beverly Hills, and the closing scene was something we just pulled this on this guy. This was not set up. The narrator was saying as the final little joke, she says, "And the final hurdle is valet parking." And just then I pulled up in front of this big fancy hotel, and I got out, and the valet walked over, and I handed him the helmet, and he handed me a ticket, and I gave him a dollar tip, and I walked away, leaving him kind of standing there, you know, looking at the helmet and the bike, trying to figure out what to do. It was just a perfect moment. But so, anyway, oh, yeah. Yeah, the bike has 644 megabytes of hard disk. Oh, no, that's the Spark Station has 424, the Mac has 40, the main DOS up front has 40, and the little DOS machine that runs the heads-up display has 20, and then the rest is in a laptop. I think that number just changed because I got another 120 meg in the PowerBook now, so I lose track, but enough most of the time. But, you know, that won't last. There's a law floating around that is the system user's level of expectation is always 20% greater than available capacity. So, you know, it's... It affects every. In fact, another little comment about that law. I was in I was visiting the Cray-2 installation when NASA Ames Research Center opened up, and I was getting the grand tour of this wonderful new big fast machine from the guy who was the sysadmin for it, I guess. And so I quoted that law to him, and I said, "Is that even true here?" And he got this funny look in his face. He goes, "Yeah, I guess so. It only took about 2 weeks before, oh wow, turned into come on." So. Same with data rate, I think. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. I'm glad you brought that up. Security system. There are 5 levels of security sensors on board, and a lot of different... Basically, the nice thing about having it all set up in software is that there is an ability to take all these different stimuli and different possible actions and correlate them as appropriate. Like, for example, one of the levels of security, one of the sensors is a microwave motion sensor. It knows if anybody's within about 10 or 15 feet. It's an alpha sensor, 10 gigahertz feed horn under the helmet. If I'm putting the bike in somebody's backyard and they say, it's okay, nobody ever goes back there, well, then I want to know if somebody's within 10 or 15 feet. If I'm parked in front of a restaurant, I don't want to know if somebody's within 10 or 15 feet. So there's all these different responses, okay? So the sensors are that, the Ungo box, which is a physical motion sensor, the automotive security, it's wonderful. That's the one I use most. Any access panel being opened. The wheel movement or the GPS receiver, there's a Trimble GPS receiver up on the front of the console there. If the latitude and longitude change more than some set amount without the right password, then we have obviously a security alert. And the response to that, of course, would be to call 911 and use the speech synthesizer to say, hello, I'm a bicycle, I'm being stolen, my coordinates are, you know. I have no idea what the cops would do with this information, but... Actually, the more reliable response to that problem would be to use the Qualcomm terminal, because there's always somebody at the hub down in San Diego. Send a help message, which is already location stamped, so fewer things have to work. You can just yank a panic line. There's also a security siren on there, which is, I don't know if you noticed it, right in the back of the rump facing the trailer, there's a little siren that sweeps into the ultrasonic at about 130 dB. It's positioned there because that bounces off the curved front of the trailer and creates a zone of terror on either side of the bike that no chasing dog is able to penetrate, unless he's deaf. See, yes? Is it stay in winter weather? Yeah, I go south when it's cold if possible. I don't always get it timed right. I got snowed in at Telluride, but that's kind of a nice fate. I also, the other problem too, I did West Texas in July, which I don't recommend at all. So, yeah. Not at all. Skin is waterproof. The only thing that's really not waterproof on there is the front panel, and there's a cover that Velcros over that. And I put a baggie over the heads-up display, and everything else pretty well is fine. So I've had many all-day rain rides where the thing just gets drenched, and it doesn't seem to bother it. It's a good thing, because there's just no way to plan around that. So. Any more? Yes. Well, that's the wonderful thing about having sponsors, is I have no idea how much any of this stuff costs. I don't know. John, what would it be? It's 0.2 cents per transmitted character. That's plus a nickel a message. get you every way they can. And the terminal is, what, about 5,000 for the box?
I got two mics now. The Qualcomm satellite unit costs about $4,500 to purchase, and $35 a month is the basic rental for using the units. As Steve said, it's 0.2 cents per character that's transmitted and received, and a nickel overhead for the message. So, well, I'll let you do the math. My brain is stopping working now.
It's not cheap, but it works everywhere. That's the real advantage. Yeah. Well, that just depends on the loads, and that's highly variable. There's load shedding is done either psychologically or by computer, depending on what's going on. Normal conditions, if I'm just running a little the bicycle control processor for monitoring and cam radio and things like that, it's a few days. If there's night rides and I'm spending a lot of time on the satellite and firing up the spark station, then it could go down to a couple of days or a day. It's 45 amp hours of sealed lead acid, and the Omnitrax terminal is about 3 amps, but it's only on for typically 15 minutes at a time. Spark station's about 3 amps. Everything else is a lot less. So, the little PC that runs the heads-up display, what was that, about a watt or two? I forget, something like that. It's actually pretty rarely do I actually have to plug it in. I've gone many months without ever plugging it. There, I do have an AC charger. There's a 12-volt 8-amp line-operated switcher on there that lets me recharge in a motel room. Anyone? Yeah. Oh, sure, the Chord keyboard. There's 7 keys on each side. That actually comprises 2 handlebar keyboards, 2 Chord keyboards. Basic idea, of course, is that you can get, if you're using 5 buttons, you've got 32 combinations. With 7 buttons, you can do everything you need for full ASCII. So the strobe is the release for any number of bits transitioning to no bits. Says take the OR of all the ones that happened since the last occurrence of that and call it a character. Now, on the Winnebago 2, I did that from scratch and just hacked it into a Radio Shack Model 100 and just basically rebuilt its keyboard interface. This one is a commercial product, which unfortunately the company is sort of belly up at the moment, but it's called the InfoGrip. They had a product called the BAT. And they implemented it in ROM, and I think it's an ADC31 or something like that. So basically it's a chip, and you hand it cord closures, and it pretends to be either a PC or a Mac keyboard, depending on which way you have a jumper set. Now, the thing about that, the cord keyboard is really great because you can use it in places where you can't use a regular one. So I absolutely require it here. However, it's about half your normal typing speed because it's more of a synchronous kind of movement. You can't have these little licks, where you take advantage of N-key rollover. The solution to that problem is to use a macro expansion. And so for that, I have PRD Plus, which lets me take up to about 8,000 RAM resident macros. If I want to say thank you very much, it's TYVM, and it just automatically expands that. And you can have tons of those things, and it catches them on the fly, expands them, and then passes them off to the target. So the effective throughput is on straight text is in excess of 100 words a minute. Okay, well, the why was kind of a political thing that I probably shouldn't go into. CompuServe is a very robust system, but there are just some personal things, and I ended up moving over to Genie many years ago. That doesn't affect my recommendations about what systems to use, though. I mean, still the big supermarket is still CompuServe. I really prefer internet, though. I've gotten to the point now where I'm using Genie for communication with about five or six people, and I have an area on there called Nomad where my stories are all archived. So I'm publishing there, and it's a great place. There's all kinds of wonderful downloads and things. If I want to get a Mac utility or something, it's a lot easier for me to go get it there than find it on the net. The pervasiveness of the internet is so much greater that it's 95% of my use now. Yeah. So they're so different. One of the things I used to complain about before I started living on the internet is what I was calling islands. No, what was I calling them? Oh, layers of data space. And there was almost like a new network nationalism that develops between the commercial services. It's like, I'm on Genie and you're on CompuServe, so you're weird, And then there's all the ones like Delphi and all these other little environments and Prodigy, and they all have their own particular flavor. And other than fairly low, narrow little pipes of email gateways, they generally don't talk to each other very much. And what's bothering me is that what we really ought to have is a variety of comfortable user environments. So if you happen to like the way Prodigy behaves, which I find difficult, but if you like that particular kind of graphic of user interface, then fine, get a Prodigy account, but your connectivity should be the same as everybody else's. And it's annoying to me right now that I require still three or four different accounts. I still got to go someplace to check my MCI mail because there are people who don't know how to use MCI's EMS to get to the internet. There are too many different things I still have to look at every day in order to not annoy people who have read published addresses that I was foolish enough to propagate. Anyway, did you have something you want to say, John? Okay. Not often enough. I do have a backup beeper I got off a bulldozer that goes off whenever I do that. really critical files I send to my base office or stick on floppy if I happen to remember it. I've been lulled into a false sense of security by a lot of luck in that department, so my answer, some future time may be different. But yes, but not enough. Yeah. What personal belongings? Well, everything I need for a full-time life on the road. I have a tent and a sleeping bag and all the usual camping stuff, stove and oven and so on. Lots of t-shirts, medical supplies, R&D lab. I don't know where you draw the line between personal and non-personal. It's like the distinction between work and play. It's gotten very, very vaporous, but very vague. Gee, I don't know. I should do an inventory again someday, but really just kind of everything I need. A lot of tools, and it's when you become a full-time nomad, things start to take on multi-functionality. Here, another thing, there's a CD player, for example, and I carry about 150 CDs, and I have them all repackaged in little plastic sleeves. So, just the basic essentials. Landing gear, please. Not training wheels. I can't believe it. Yeah. It's the lateral stabilization unit. Yes, they do retract. There's a double-acting pneumatic cylinder down there, and there's a tank over on the far side of the bike. And I can push a button, and the cylinder retracts them. There's a four-bar mechanism. And normally they're up at any normal speed. I deploy them for extremely low speeds, crawling up steep hills. Or if I'm parking, like when I pulled in here just now, I was riding in and I just pushed the button and they swung down. I just got off. I didn't have to mess with the kickstand. So hills can be challenging. When you're on something this heavy, like so when I'm sitting on it at 780 pounds, that's somewhat comparable to a full-size semi tractor trailer rig with a 12 horsepower riding lawnmower engine in power to weight ratio. So that's why it's 105 gears. And in fact, everything becomes a little bit more challenging. Like, for example, when I get on a steep hill, if I stop partway up the hill and then have to start again, the impulse energy necessary to do that can blow the drivetrain fuse. Some people call that a freewheel. I got in that situation, something like that, and again, it was Wisconsin. It's a rather glaciated area, and so there's some brutal little short hills back there that don't go on very long, like the length of this room maybe, but they're killers. They hadn't heard of grading when they built them. And this particular one happened to be gravel. I was on my way into a campground, and I got about halfway up this hill, and I lost traction. And no matter what I did, the rear wheel would just spin. So I locked the brakes. I'm just sitting there. Well, I can't go forward anymore, and I obviously can't go back, and I can't go to either side. So I'm kind of waiting for an airlift or something. And all of a sudden, the disc brake from hell unscrewed. I had this disc brake screwed onto the Philwood hub back there, and it, you know, it's hydraulic, nice, you know, great thing. Unfortunately, the guy who built the brake didn't expect people to want to stop going backwards, especially with a big heavy bike. So the brake just unscrewed, and of course, the whole thing starts rolling out of control down the hill, which, and it didn't take many seconds at all before the trailer jackknifed and the thing went down. Well, my feet were still locked in the pedals. I wasn't expecting this at all. So now I'm lying on my side with the thing putting a big hole in my thigh, and I've got one hand on the ground trying to keep it from hitting me any harder, and I'm now trapped under my bicycle. And this is a horribly humiliating position to be in, trapped under your bicycle. It just doesn't sound right. So, yeah, so I just kind of, there wasn't much I could do, so I just stayed there for a while, and, you know, I was going to answer some email or something, but unfortunately, with this... No, the satellite that was on the trailer, so it was still pointing the right way, but no, actually, it was far too painful for that. And fortunately, a guy on a motorcycle came along, and he, I waved, and he stopped, and he said, well, what is that? So I promised him a full demo if he would lift it off of me. So he did, and I did, yeah. The brakes are not only not stock, but they're also not adequate at the moment. I have a Magura hydraulic on the front, caliper, the one on the front is. And it's actually a pretty good brake. On the rear, I've got a disc brake that was custom made from a sort of a go-kart. It was a Magura, I can't remember their names now, Gromyka. A Gromyka motorcycle brake and a Magura handle and a racing go-kart disc. I mean, it's sort of this hodgepodge. And I never quite got around to doing the surge braking system on the trailer, which really needs to be done. The trailer needs its own brakes and currently doesn't have them. Plus, there's a parking brake on the rear, which I added after this experience in Wisconsin. It's also an emergency backup brake. So that's on a shift lever instead of a standard brake lever, so I can lock the brake. And I use that all the time now if I'm parking on any kind of a grade at all. So, any more? Okay. Pardon? 11,422 feet, I think, Spring Creek Pass, and I've done 7 passes in the Rockies, all admittedly on earlier versions of this that weighed less, but the thing about the Rockies is that the grades are almost never worse than 9%, except part of the north side of Slumgullion, so really the worst stuff is in the Appalachians, where they just think around, and some of the stuff up in New England. The road's built long enough ago that there were no laws about maximum grades. They say, oh, look, a mountain, and they just, you know, right over it. It's less asphalt that way. Okay, yeah. Not yet. That's coming. I've been doing an awful lot of stuff with Japanese media and European media lately, and there's a pretty good chance of a European tour, I would say, coming up. I'm not sure whether that'll be first or Japan, but it's inevitable. I'm getting more and more interested in that. So, incidentally, I was filming with NHK a few years ago in Japan, and I made the mistake of casually mentioning during the pre-interview that with this ham radio, I can even talk to Japan. Well, that went in the notebook, and so I was riding along, and the producer leaned out the window of the chase vehicle while I was on camera and said, okay, now you must talk to Japan. Okay. Well, ham radio's not like that. You see, there's propagation, and you know, I'm trying to explain all that. They didn't want to hear it. They wanted me to talk to Japan. Oh, no. So I sort of got the antenna all set up and everything. And fortunately, 10 meters was open, and I was in California, and it was in the fall, and it was very easy to there were a lot of Japanese hams on 10 meters. And I started talking with this guy named Hideo in Osaka. So the requirement was for me to now explain the bicycle to him while riding and being filmed for Japanese television. Okay, so I spoke no Japanese at all at the time, now just a little tiny bit. But I was, I'm riding along telling Hideo about this thing and trying very carefully to choose my words to get across this language barrier, and I finally let off the microphone and, you know, there are cameras monitoring all this, and he came back and he goes, oh, Harry Davidson! So it's really hard to explain this thing verbally. I mean, you know, it's a language barrier even when I'm talking to American hams, but... I can't remember the question that prompted that whole story. But, oh, traveling outside the United States. Yeah, so I still very much want to do that, and I think the potential for interesting learning in both directions is there. So, any more questions? Well, let's wind down. You feel free to check this thing out in detail. If I get sufficient demand, I might even open the hood. Thanks. Hey, and thank you guys for coming and helping here. I appreciate it. So.